in health reform. Today's briefing, which is entitled How Will Consumers Navigate New Healthcare Options, is a joint project of the Kaiser Family Foundation and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. The program is being recorded, and the webcast recording will be posted on the Kaiser Family Foundation website later today. That's kff.org. And it will also be on the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation website, which is rwjf.org. My name is Lori Grubstein, and I'm a program officer with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation is committed to helping states with implementation of the coverage provisions of the Affordable Care Act, and we believe that in order for the Affordable Care Act to be successful, consumers will need to have a positive experience accessing their newly available coverage and maintaining it, and the role of consumer assistance in all of this will be critical. I'm thrilled to be here today with my co-host, Karen Politz, who's a senior fellow at the Kaiser Family Foundation. And truly, she is one of the most passionate and knowledgeable people in the area of consumer assistance that I know. Karen and I are joined by a panel of experts on consumer assistance. In just a few moments, we'll be hearing from our panelists, and then we'll have time for some Q&A with all of you. So before we move into the panel discussion, I'd like to turn it over to my co-host, Karen Politz. She's going to be setting the stage by offering some background information on consumer assistance in health insurance and related provisions and programs in the Affordable Care Act. So, Karen, please take it away.
Thanks, and good morning, everyone. Welcome on this rainy day. Let's talk about a very sunny topic, consumer assistance, one of my favorite things. I want to extend a special thanks to Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. It's terrific to do this joint project with them, and particularly to Lori for hosting this event. No one can rival Lori when it comes to passion and expertise in consumer assistance. For years, she has led Robert Wood Johnson's Covering Kids and Families initiative, which has helped to extend health coverage to millions of children. So I'll be number two to her today. Thanks to our panelists for joining us. We've got great expertise people working in the field to help consumers every day and to build new capacity. As Lori mentioned, I'm going to give you just a little bit of background about what the Affordable Care Act provides for in the way of consumer assistance, just so we all kind of have that in common, and then we'll switch to our panel discussion. There are going to be a lot of changes that take place in our healthcare system starting this coming January. Lots of new coverage options under Medicaid and under private plans, new subsidies, which will be a great thing for consumers, but it's not an automatic assumption that they will show up and enroll where they're supposed to be the first time and not have any problems. People will need a lot of assistance understanding what the changes are. Our tracking polls find that 2/3 of uninsured Americans and a majority of Americans overall don't know how the Affordable Care Act will affect them. So they're going to need help to find where they belong in the new system and get enrolled. Once they're enrolled, some of them are going to need help staying that way. The eligibility rules can be somewhat complicated, and if your circumstances change during the year, for example, if your income changes, it may be that you need to switch programs or adjust the subsidy that you're getting so that you don't end up owing the IRS money at the end of the year. People are going to need help kind of walking through that. Beyond enrollment, people need help with their health insurance now, all the time. Surveys of people in private coverage, both individual market and job-based coverage, find that it's a very frequent occurrence for people to have questions and problems with their health insurance. One in four, for example, of folks that we surveyed in a recent poll with NPR and Harvard School of Public Health found that one in four privately insured people reported denied claims for coverage for care that they thought was going to be covered, and most of them couldn't fix that on their own. They either ended up paying out of pocket or doing without the care. So people need help with their problems, and importantly, a need for consumer assistance, since there are a lot of us in this country, in addition to helping people with their problems one at a time, is to create kind of a feedback loop so that health plans and regulators can understand what problems are and address them so that they don't keep recurring millions of times over. The Affordable Care Act provides for two main sources of consumer assistance. The first one are ombudsman programs or statewide consumer assistance programs. Folks in the biz call them CAPS. These are kind of the most comprehensive programs in their design. They are supposed to provide one-stop shopping and help you with pretty much everything that you need, whether it's understanding your coverage options and enrolling in them, applying for subsidies, appealing decisions, appealing denied claims. The CAP programs are supposed to do all that. They are also supposed to collect data on the kinds of consumer problems that they see and report that back to regulators in order to strengthen enforcement. The CAP program started in 2010. It is a state option to create these. They're funded by federal grants, but states don't have to apply for grants, and not all of them have. So far, 36 states and the District of Columbia have established a CAP. Among the states that don't have one, some were discouraged because funding was pretty limited. The ACA only appropriated $30 million for this program in the first year. It was anticipated that Congress would come back, I think, and appropriate more money in subsequent years, but of course that hasn't been happening. So some of these programs have been running on a shoestring. States have been kind of figuring out ways to keep some of them running. Others are operating at a low level. And then there's been politics in CAPS along with everything else in the ACA. There have been a couple of states that turned back their CAP grants after the 2010 elections, and apparently Florida just decided to do that recently this week. These are, I think, important and comprehensive programs, but the future of them is still unfolding because of this funding uncertainty. Then there is consumer assistance through exchanges, and that is mostly focused on outreach and enrollment assistance because it's through the exchanges where people are going to connect with these new coverage options starting in 2014. The Affordable Care Act provides for navigators, as the name suggests, to help you navigate your new coverage options and enroll in them. In addition, some mirror kind of programs have been created, including in-person assistance programs. These are very similar to navigators. They complement these programs. These have been created to kind of deal with a timing problem in the funding for navigators. Navigators are supposed to be funded out of the operating revenue that exchanges get, but of course that won't start flowing until January of next year, and the navigator programs are supposed to be ready for open enrollment this fall. So these IPA programs can be funded out of grants that states are entitled to draw down to stand up their exchanges. A lot of money has been drawn down by states to create these IPA programs. So Arkansas, for example, has budgeted $17 million for its IPA program just for the first year. Maryland, where I live, has allocated $25 million for the first year for its Navigator IPA programs. In your packets, you've got a snapshot of where some of these state Navigator IPA programs are today. It's changing, you know, every week, but I encourage you to take a look at that. By contrast, for the 33 federally operated exchange states, HHS just announced it'll make $54 million available for Navigator grants. HHS doesn't have access to those state grants to offer IPAs. There's going to be some difference in funding in terms of consumer assistance through the exchanges, at least in the first year. There also can be these certified application counselors, which are essentially volunteer or pro bono counselors, and exchanges have to have call centers and information and assistance on their websites. In addition, the Medicaid program will continue to have assisters to help people enroll in that program, funds have been increasing for that in many states. And then, of course, brokers and agents traditionally have been where people turn to get information about health plans that are offered, compare their choices, and enroll. And that will continue in 2014 as well. So how's all this going to work? Well, hard to say. I expect there probably will be challenges, and so it may not work perfectly in the first year. The funding limits, which I've just alluded to, there's going to be uneven availability of money for consumer assistance in the first year, depending on, you know, what sort of funding streams are available and can be drawn down by states versus the federal government. The time challenge, everyone's kind of keeping an eye on that as the clock ticks toward October 1. We still have to stand up these programs, train people, get them ready so they can do their outreach and be ready to work. Recruiting coordinating these programs is going to be a big issue. There will be many, many new people out there assisting consumers. It's going to be important that they're providing consistent and accurate advice and that there be coordination across programs. Some states are trying to take all of these different streams of consumer assistance and put them into a kind of overall program, one-stop shopping. No matter where you go, you can get connected to the assistance you need. Others may be more specialized, and so there'll have to be coordination so that the handoff is smooth and people don't get lost in the shuffle. And then finally, there continue to be some issues in states looking at how to coordinate what these new consumer assisters will do with what navigators are doing, legislation to try to assign standards, licensing requirements, and so forth to the new consumer assisters so that they will be at least as skilled as the brokers who are out there now, but also a concern, I think, among some that some of these restrictions may impede the development of navigator programs, and that whole kind of conversation is going to continue to develop, I think, for the rest of this year. Just as a reminder, however it works in the first year, the opening act doesn't tell you everything you need to know about the whole show. Our SHIP program is a recent reminder that just because a program starts slowly doesn't mean that it won't succeed. In the first year that the SHIP program opened, only about 10% of children enrolled compared to the level of enrollment that was observed 5 years later. And that unevenness also was observed across states. Some got off to a fast start. Others were a little slower in getting going. As we watch the development of consumer assistance this year and in the following years, I think it helps to take a longer view, and there are certainly a couple of things that I'm going to be keeping an eye on over the longer term in this important field. The first is, what will the future funding look like for consumer assistance? The unevenness that we see this year has the potential for evening out in future years. Once revenue streams are coming into all exchanges, they all can get funded by this tax on insurers and estate, there will be a more even distribution of resources available. Decisions still need to get made about how much of exchange budgets will be set aside for consumer assistance. There's not a rule on that, so that's going to be an important thing to watch over time. And how these consumer assistance programs are funded over time, I think, also will be incredibly important to watch. Second, how will this all be evaluated? The interesting thing about uneven development across states is that you have an opportunity to see, you know, what is working, what isn't working, and what differences matter. Does the amount of funding matter, the amount of coordination, and so forth? So I think it will be interesting to see how much of the unevenness get smoothed out over time as a result of careful evaluation. And then finally, who will be the providers of this consumer assistance? Building this new capacity feels a little bit ad hoc right now because so much is going on and so different in many states. But eventually, there's a potential for there to be really a new profession, a new cadre of trained professionals whose job it is to help people with their health insurance problems, who are expert, who are resourced, who know what they are doing. People want this. Our polls tell us people want this. 84% of respondents to Kaiser Family Foundation surveys dating back more than 10 years tell us that consumers want a trusted source they can turn to for help with their health insurance problems. And if that can actually be developed, I think that would be a very significant accomplishment of health reform. So with that, I'm going to ask Lori to turn it over to our panel for a great discussion.
Great. Thank you, Karen. That was a really helpful overview and I think nicely sets up the discussions with our panelists, which I'll turn to now. So I'm going to ask each of our panelists a question and then give them about 5 minutes to respond. After each of the panelists has had an opportunity to address her question, Karen and I will lead a discussion with the panelists and then open it up to Q&A from the audience. So the panelists' bios are included with the agenda. So in the interest of time, I'll just briefly introduce each of our panelists, and then I'll move into the questions. So to my far right, We have Nancy Metcalf. She is the health editor of Consumer Reports magazine. Right next to me, we have Elizabeth Benjamin. She is the vice president of health initiatives at the Community Service Society in New York, and she directs a statewide consumer assistance program in New York. Next to Karen, we have Kathleen Geminer. She's the project director at the Universal Healthcare Action Network of Ohio, a nonprofit organization that runs a helpline and advocates for consumers. And then to my far left, we have Janet Trotwine. She's the CEO of the National Association of Health Underwriters here in Washington, D.C. So I'll begin with Nancy. Nancy, will you please set the stage for us by describing some of the reader inquiries that you've received about the ACA over the past few months as an illustration of the kinds of information and assistance that consumers will start seeking this fall.
I sure will. Thank you for having me. I don't get out of my office in New York very much, and it's always a treat to come to Washington where there's all a ton of wonks around. I have been covering health insurance and health reform at Consumer Reports for maybe 5 or 6 years now. I'm going to say maybe 2.5, 3 years ago, we rather rashly decided to create a mailbox for people where readers could write in with their questions about health insurance. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Could write in with questions about health insurance. And actually, thousands of questions have come in. My colleague, Lynn Quincy, and I'm sure we would be happy to make it available to you, hired somebody to do a study of what these questions were a couple of years ago, or about a year ago. But what I'm going to talk to you, had some interesting findings, but I want to talk to you really about the stuff that's come in pretty much since we knew it became clear that health reform was actually going to happen, maybe over the last year, 6 months, something like that. You've probably all seen the Kaiser tracking polls showing in mass unawareness of what's in the law. And that's a good macro view of what's going on. What I am struck by over and over again is the extreme specificity of the questions that come in to me. People don't care about the big picture of the health reform law. They care about their situation. And what they're trying to do is make sense of what they hear from their friends, see on the news, get in viral emails that people send them, to try to apply that to their situation. They're looking for a clue to what's going to happen to them. Maybe because they're writing to me, by definition, they haven't been able to find the answer. But it seems to be very, very hard for people to find the answer. I will also say that about half my questions have to do with Medicare, which has been around for 50 years, and everybody knows they're going to join eventually. And yet, when the time comes, people are completely baffled, and with good reason, because it turns out to be a lot more complicated than they could ever have imagined. But anyway, I won't talk about that. I'm going to talk about not Medicare stuff. I was trying to think of the general categories. One big category are people who seem to have no idea, one, how the system works now, or two, that it is changing. Dear Nancy, can you recommend a good maternity plan for me? I'm 12 weeks pregnant. Dear Nancy, I live in Alabama, and I think my insurance is really too expensive. It's $195 a month. Can you recommend a good plan to replace it? I'm in pretty good health, except for the anti-anxiety medications, antidepressants, and pain pills that I take. So no awareness, really, of, number one, that he's got a really cheap plan, number two, that no one is going to sell him insurance right now, or number three, that, you know, he should wait until 2014. He doesn't seem to be, you know, that 2014 is anything. Okay, another big category, and it's growing as the time draws nigh, is people who have bad health insurance situations right now. They're excited to think that maybe things can get better, but they really don't understand how it works. And I think a lot of it has to do with how the controversies get covered, often very telegraphically. I've been a journalist for many years, and you sort of get tired of writing the background and start thinking everybody knows it, and they don't. This is a man who wrote in just the other day from South Carolina. He said, "Is Obamacare canceled?" because I was really hoping to be able to get insurance. And he lives in South Carolina, and he thinks that Obamacare is canceled because the Medicaid expansion isn't happening. And that's a distinction that I'm sure everyone in this room will say, duh. But if you're a regular person, it's a really hard thing to understand. And then I've gotten many questions like that from people. Or a guy who wrote in from Florida. He said, I thought this was supposed to help people with pre-existing conditions, but it's not because you have to wait for 6 months to get covered, and it's still a lot of money. And he was conflating the PCIP with health reform, with what's going to happen in 2014. No awareness that there was a difference. And then there are people who've really tried very hard to learn about it, have read stuff, and still can't work out how it's going to relate to them. They just don't quite trust themselves. Dear Nancy, I've just been diagnosed with breast cancer and will probably have a lumpectomy. Do you think my insurance will try to drop me after the lumpectomy costs? With health reforms, will insurers still be able to deny people for pre-existing conditions? Now, I will say, she prefaced her letter with, "I've read all your information on health reform," which says 20 different places that in 2014 you can't get turned, you won't be denied. And she doesn't believe it, or she's scared or something like that. I also hear from a lot of people with really bad insurance policies who seem weirdly frightened that they're going to have to give them up. Dear Nancy, I have an individual policy with a $10,000 deductible. It excludes drug coverage and does not provide any free preventive care. Come January 2014, will that plan be required to change or cease operation? I have searched and searched, but virtually 100% of the answers I can find assume the asker will be seeking a brand new policy. And I wrote him back, I'm waiting to hear the answer. Why do you want to keep that policy? But he's clearly afraid that he's not going to be able to get something better. At least that's my theory. And then a big, big category are people in situations that whoever, the people in Congress who wrote this law, I'm guessing didn't think that much about. For example, who knew there were so many people on Medicare with young adult children? That was at the minute that 26 and under thing went in, I started getting questions saying, I'm on Medicare and I've got a 22-year-old. My most memorable one was this woman who wrote in, I think she was from Ohio actually, she said, I'm a professor at a university. I'm so wanting to retire. I've been working my whole life. I'm 66 years old. I'm eligible for Medicare. But then she was a widow. Where would I get insurance for my three kids aged 24, 22, and 19? Three kids under 26, and she's 66 years old. I mean, do you want to just go?
What's wrong with that?
Doesn't it make you want to take a nap right now?
Every day.
Also, this was, who knew there were so many retired Canadians who spend 6 months of the year in Florida? And it turns out they have a terrible time getting health coverage when they have to buy these temporary policies, and they're expensive, and they can't always get them, and it drives them crazy. And they want to know, well, gee, now can I buy health insurance for when I'm in Florida? And I haven't had time to tackle that one yet because it turns out, according to one of them, that there's some kind of special passport thing that Canadians can get. And, if they're here for longer than 3 months, I think the answer is they can, which is kind of weird. But, I'm sure whoever wrote this law didn't ever think about this. Another huge category, Dear Nancy, my 75-year-old mother is moving here from China. This is from the daughter or son who've immigrated years before, and the elderly parents are now getting older or have retired or whatever and are going to come and join their children in the United States. These are people who have permanent, you know, green cards, are permanent residents. And how do I get them health care? Well, the answer has been up until now, as I'm sure you know, it's really hard and sometimes impossible. Of course, now these people will be able to get into exchanges. But what happens 5 years down the road when they're finally eligible for Medicare, and will they have to go on Medicare and spend $1,000 a month for a couple to buy in? Because you can buy in after 5 years or not. I'm still working on the answer to that. Another big one is people looking for proof of negatives. You may have all seen the viral email from that circulates among senior citizens saying, you know, after Obamacare happens, there's not going to be cancer care for people over 75 or 80 or all different ages. I actually asked HHS to make a statement about this. I did a little piece in the magazine about it a couple months ago, and here's what they wrote me back. This was after many back and forths. The health care law makes Medicare stronger and reduces costs for seniors. In fact, this year alone, more than 20 million seniors have received preventive care at no additional cost. I didn't even run it because that's embarrassing. You know, they didn't answer the question. These people are not worried about not being able to get a flu shot. They're worried about being diagnosed with cancer and left to die. You know, that you have to address the negative. Another question that comes in all the time is people who want to know, is there an asset test for getting subsidies or for getting on Medicaid? And they'll say, I've looked and looked and looked and I can't find the answer to that. Again, it's a negative. They can't find the answer because there isn't an asset test. But, you know, you need to say there's no asset test, because poor people, low-income people, life experiences, if anybody's going to help you, you can't have a lot of assets, and they're not just going to care about income. My time is almost up, but I know there's going to be more discussion of this, but the biggest train wreck of all, I see, the thing that I'm worried about the most, are people who want to know how their work insurance is going to be affected. One big category are people with erratic hours, adjunct professors, freelancers, people who work for these contract employers, and they're not even sure who's their employer. They often have terrible coverage. People who have health plans where the employee and maybe the children coverage is pretty cheap, but to add the spouse is I've $800 more a month, you know, and they're going to say, gee, can we get subsidies now? And I'm afraid the answer in a lot of cases is going to be, no, you can't. And I will say that there's a lot of information out there about employer insurance and the Affordable Care Act. 100% of it is addressed to employers. I have not been able to find a single place or source of information that is addressed to employees and what their rights are, who they can ask about it, what to expect. I'm trying to write it for them, and it's just very, very hard. And I think that the consumer assistance and navigator people are going to need to be prepared to get a lot of questions about that. So, oh, and one more thing. A lot of people are really interested in getting dental insurance. So that's my impressions.
Thank you, Nancy. I think your remarks really underscore the need for high-quality, well-organized consumer assistance. So now we're going to turn to Elizabeth Benjamin. So, Elizabeth, will you please describe for us the kinds of services that your network provides in New York and the approach that New York has taken in establishing, organizing, and funding its consumer assistance capacity? And I should mention, New York is a state that will have a state-run exchange. So Elizabeth.
So thank you, Lori and Karen, for having me here. And those were wonderful stories. And I won't tell. Normally, I usually start with a story, but I think we've got the story, you know, quota for the day. But a lot of those folks call us in New York State. And it's, you know, the bottom line is insurance is really complicated and people don't want to deal with it. None of us do. It's the thing you always put off until the last possible minute in open enrollment when your job. It's the thing, you know, if you lose your eligibility for a program, it's, you know, you lose it and then you have to get re-enrolled. It's just really a burden for folks to deal with. And it's because it's just kept so complicated for us. One of the beautiful things about the Affordable Care Act is hopefully it'll get a little simpler. And a lot of states like New York are really taking this opportunity to make things more streamlined and more simple for consumers. I run a statewide consumer assistance program. It's called Community Health Advocates. We have sort of two components. One is really serving the kind of individual consumers who've been reaching out to Nancy, and that is run through a network of 30 community-based organizations. And these are groups that are in local neighborhoods. They're really trusted people. It may be a rural group up in upstate New York, because New York's this funny combination of Appalachia and the South Bronx, right? Or it might be, you know, a Korean community counseling services in southern Queens. And so we have, you know, these different groups of trusted community-based groups that do sort of – they're your sort of ground troops that are doing door-to-door, store-to-store education, really trying to get people sort of up to speed and hopefully eventually we'll be able to offer people more enrollment choices than we can now. Right now we're pretty limited. We have the high-risk pool, the PCIP program, the pre-existing condition insurance plan we have, which is no longer open for enrollment in New York. We have the Children's Health Insurance Program, the SCHIP program, Medicaid, and then this very distressed individual market. The other component to our program is we also run a network of small business assistance. It's called the Small Business Assistance Programs, and this is using a network of 34 local community chambers of commerce or business-serving groups. And that really tries to reach employers and their employees through, again, trusted messengers. For a community group that serves low-income people is not going to be the best messenger to go to a small, manufacturing organization in Westchester that may employ 20 people. And so we need to have sort of different messengers, and I think that would be one of the big sort of take-home messages from the New York program. The other thing that is resourced under the sort of high-level consumer assistance program in the Affordable Care Act, and we're a little nervous about the funding right now, but is a capacity to help those of us who have employer-sponsored, job-sponsored coverage right now. Everybody, when you go to your doctor, your insurance company pays hopefully all of it, but sometimes it's some of it and sometimes it's none of it. And we get notice of how much your insurance company has paid on these things called explanation of benefits. Our phone number at Community Health Advocates is at the bottom of all the carriers in New York State's explanation of benefits. And if people want or disagree with how much their carrier paid their doctor or stuck with the balance bill, they can reach out to us and we will help them deal with the payment issues. Or if their carrier is denying them cancer treatment or a wheelchair or something like that, or a special treatment for, you know, Hashimoto's encephalopathy, which we now know all about in our shop, they will call us and we will figure out a way to get that treatment for that person's daughter. And that's through a dedicated live answer hotline. So our model really is what we call a hub and spokes model. We have this centralized hotline that does data collection, quality assurance, really well staffed with very expert, you know, essentially insurance lawyers and very, very seasoned paralegals. And then we have these two sort of spoke-light networks of community-based groups that are most trusted. These would be groups that serve people of color, low-income folks, people that may be more vulnerable and are not comfortable calling a hotline. And our data shows that lower income people with less English fluency or maybe have less educational levels really want to be having in-person a service. And then we also run this, and then the sort of more higher educated folks and college educated people, people who are on the jobs, don't have a lot of time, they really just want to call and get the answer. So we try to have both components covered there. And then this network of business serving groups, chambers, which have their own methods of getting the word out, maybe in a chamber's newsletter, maybe doing rounds on the chamber, it may be at a breakfast networking meeting, it may be through working with local accountants in that region. And so we have this sort of dual nature of trying to get these trusted messengers out in the street. The other thing that I really think should not be underestimated, and I think one of the big lessons from the New York experience, is when there are problems, we are able to identify them quickly. For example, right away with health reform went in, one of the things that started happening is there were no more certain benefit limits were eliminated. And there was a carrier still in New York State that was still advertising products with benefit limits. We were able to notify the carrier, the insurance plan, say, hey, your materials aren't quite right. Notify the state, let the regulators know that some of the carriers were still sort of had the wrong information up on their website. And in fact, we're still enrolling people in impermissible products. And so, you know, no one was fined or whatever, but, you know, we just sort of got the practice to be stopped, got the person in the right product. And that's the kind of sort of feedback loop, that canary in the coal mine. Let's get these problems addressed and resolved right away before they become a train wreck. So we don't want any train wrecks. We don't have to have train wrecks. I think this is really a moment where we all need to come together. And I think programs like ours can really bring lots of resources, lots of boots on the ground, you know, door to door, store to store. Let's get everybody who's eligible enrolled and really sort of bring the anxiety down a notch. I just think from our calls, from the work we do and our outreach, we just hear of a lot of anxiety, and I think our programs can really sort of, if they're, you know, properly resourced and out there, can really bring down the anxiety. And I think, I know we're running a little behind schedule, so I'm going to stop there to sort of do some catch up on the timing, but thank you.
Great. Thank you so much, Elizabeth, for those remarks. Now we're going to hear about...
One last thing. Sure. If you want to know more about it, our report's at the back, and it sort of gives you a lot of statistics about... And I can give you more statistics about, you know, how much of the wages or who we're offering coverage to and all that stuff if you guys are interested. So.
Great, thanks. So now we're going to hear about a very different state, Ohio. So Kathleen, would you please discuss consumers' needs in Ohio, which will have a federally facilitated exchange, and challenges that must be faced in order to provide effective consumer assistance in your state.
Thanks, Lori. And I just also want to thank Kaiser Family Foundation and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation for convening this briefing opportunity. And I'm happy to share what's going on in Ohio. And as you mentioned, Ohio is a state that's not going to have its own marketplace, not going to have a consumer assistance partnership. And let me just explain what that means. Had Ohio decided to do a consumer assistance partnership, we could have gotten literally millions of dollars into the state that would have been used to hire people called assisters who would have gone out and been able to educate the many people in Ohio who have questions. And UCAN Ohio does a lot of speaking in the community, and so here's what I'm finding that people are really concerned about. And some of this mirrors what Nancy talked about earlier, but people really want information right now. They want information about how the law is going to affect them, and particularly, again, people who have employer coverage want to know how it will affect them. People who have no coverage want to know what their opportunities will be. And those with pre-existing conditions are very concerned because they've been rejected in the past and they want some assurance as to how the law will help them. People want to understand what benefits they're going to get. They're very concerned about whether or not doctor's visits are covered, prescriptions are covered, and what, you know, the other kinds of benefits that will be in their plans. They want to know how much it's going to cost them. And this, of course, usually has kind of a two-part answer. One is, we don't know exactly, which doesn't go over well in the groups that I speak to. And the other is, we can help you figure out a ballpark if you're eligible for a subsidy, if your income is under 400% of the poverty level, because you can go to the Kaiser Family Foundation and look at the calculator and put your income in and see what percentage of income you're expected to spend on health insurance, and this will help you get a ballpark. It will not give you exactly what you, the exact cost, but it will help you. The other thing that I think people need, from what I can see, is they need a means of engagement. And by that, what I mean is that if we go out and talk to people and they're very engaged at that moment, and we're answering their questions just as best as we can with the information we have, but it's April and enrollment is in October. So how do we keep those folks in Zanesville or in Toledo or in Mansfield interested between now and October and continuing to gather the information that's coming out so that they'll really be ready? And I think there needs to be some way that people can become, you know, whether it's, I know that they can go on to the website and that healthcare.gov, and that there's more functionality that's coming onto that that will help people be engaged. But I just think that's an area where all of us have to think a lot about, well, what can we do to really make sure that the people who have a question now and want to get enrolled and want to do the right thing in October will keep getting the information between now and October that will keep them engaged. They also need preparation for what they're going to face. They need to know that insurance will cost them something. This isn't free unless they qualify for Medicaid. And unfortunately, at this point, Ohio has not yet adopted the Medicaid expansion, and this is a pretty big hot topic, actually, back in the state. And so people need to know insurance has a subsidy, but you're still expected to pay something. They need to think about how they will budget. We need to help them have realistic expectations, or let's say manage their expectations as we move between now and October. So some of the challenges that we're facing. Ohio is very under-resourced right now. I mentioned already that our state chose not to take the consumer partnership, which would have given us millions of dollars for our sisters that could be out right now educating people. So that's big. We will get a navigator grants in Ohio. $2.2 million has been set aside for our state. We have $1.5 million uninsured. But just to put that to scale, I heard yesterday that Colorado will be spending $7 million to address 600,000 uninsured. And we'll have $2.2 million to address $1.5 million uninsured. So, you know, it's going to be a challenge. It will be a real challenge. Now, having said that, we have an amazing consumer network in Ohio and various groups that have been talking to each other for months and months, and we are prepared to really make this work and work with the resources that we have. But we will continue to reach out and try to bring more resources into the state as we can, to make sure that we can really do the very best job for Ohio consumers. Another challenge that we have, and I'll try to be brief because I think I'm hitting towards the end of my time, is that a law is in the process of going through the legislature, a bill, which we expect to be passed, that will impose certain requirements both on brokers and on navigators with respect to the state. So the federal government will actually be providing the money and providing training requirements and certification, tests that have to be passed and all of these things. But the Ohio legislature has decided they also want to certify navigators. And so there will be these dual systems. And we're worried about that. We want to make sure that navigators can do their jobs, that the organizations that get this very small amount of money that's out there now are not spending money on background checks and things that will already have been done through the federal government. So we really want to make sure there's no duplication. Merging these requirements, these state-federal requirements, is very important to us. And finally, I'll just close by saying the challenge that we face is, unfortunately, among some of our leaders in the state, there is a very anti-Affordable Care Act sentiment, and it's been expressed frequently. And so we aren't simply educating people, let's say, from you know, a baseline up. We have to overcome negative information and negative sentiment that's been put out in the media in order to help people understand what the Affordable Care Act can do for them, and then lead them all the way down the path from first learning what it will do to them to the point of actually getting enrolled starting in October. So I'll close there. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Kathleen. Very helpful to hear how everything's playing out in Ohio right now. So finally, Janet, we'd like you to please talk about the role that agents and brokers have traditionally played in providing consumer assistance and what role they'll play in the new world of consumer assistance starting this fall.
Sure. Thank you. So some of you in the room may not really understand what agents and brokers are, so I want to tell you a little bit about that and how they operate. So we hear of the word agent and broker, and you might hear another term called producer. And there are legal definitions between those three terms, but for practical purposes and the way they work with the consumers, they mean exactly the same thing. And it's just someone who assists the consumer in the purchase of private health insurance, either as an individual or a small business, a large business, a giant business. Agents and brokers work with all of those. An agent and broker does a lot of things other than helping someone find coverage. They tend to talk to their clients in a way that looks at their entire financial picture so that when they make a recommendation or let them know about the things available, it is with those ideas in mind so that this fits into their overall financial structure, whether that's an individual they're speaking with, an employee of an employer, the employer themselves, and so forth. Each of these have separate goals and things that they're trying to do based on their overall goals that don't have to do with health insurance. And this is very important. We have been doing this for years. Agents and brokers are licensed by the state. Every agent and broker, producer, whatever the word is, they all have to meet continuing education requirements every year, in addition to their pre-licensing training, which is about 40 hours of training, and then every year they get about 15 hours of continuing education credit, or their license will be revoked. So it's quite strict. It's upheld on a continual basis. So you can, and then in addition to that, agents and brokers also buy most of the carriers that they work with, and just because it's good business practice, have errors and omissions insurance, which is also something that is a little bit different. So even though everyone here we're all assisting consumers, and I think we should work together in that, there are a few things that are different about the way the regulations apply. They have separate regulations that apply under HIPAA privacy laws, under the Gramm-Leach-Bliley law, which regulates financial privacy. And so it's a highly regulated profession, and that's the point that I wanted to make. Having said that, the job of the agent and broker is far beyond helping someone buy coverage. In fact, more than half of an agent and broker's time is spent after the fact helping them with things that come up, because a lot of things do come up. It can be something as simple as, I have a new baby. This is good news. Let's add them on to the policy, to something really serious where a coverage has been denied, and which is often due to something not being filed correctly or additional information being needed. It's not always an outright denial, even though the consumer may perceive that, or understanding what their EOB means, what their responsibility is relative to that bill. And those are the things that happen all the time. We have every expectation that all of that sort of work is going to continue on. We have been working closely with the federal government and the various states around the country to ensure that that we will continue to be operating in that fashion. We've been told multiple times by the Federal Exchange that they are depending on us to make sure that people do get enrolled, and so we expect that to continue. Having said that, there are some new challenges that will come up, and I want to just touch on a couple of those. I guess we can start off talking about individuals, and I do want to echo what Kathleen said about unrealistic expectations about the cost. A lot of people who may be hearing about these programs for the first time do have an expectation when they see that their income level may be within the parameters described, less than 400% of the poverty level. They think that means it will be free. Or they think that when they go to the doctor, there will be no cost sharing on their part. And this is an obstacle that we are dealing with fairly frequently. Like Elizabeth, we and Nancy and everyone here, we are getting many questions every day. We average 50 to 100 questions per day on various aspects, many of them employer plan related questions that come from our members on behalf of the clients that they represent. One of the other issues relative to the individual market, there will be some small employers, particularly those who operate on these razor-thin margins, that may decide not to offer coverage as a small employer anymore and instead to have their employees go to the exchange and try to qualify for coverage there. And so the challenge with those groups is to make sure that the employees actually go to the exchange and apply for coverage and that they don't just scatter like so much dust to the wind. And so we're trying to set up systems and ways for people to make sure that everybody gets covered, because I think that's what all of our goal is. Then we also have people who work for employers but who have not traditionally been covered by their plans. Sometimes it's because they turned down an offer of coverage because they were more interested in having a higher paycheck, and that's a reasonable expectation. But some of them will be eligible for coverage and don't realize that they will be because the definition of a full-time employee will be different than what it is for many employers today. So there are a lot of complicating situations where people may think they're eligible for something, not know they're eligible, not know that the fact that they're eligible may definitely and will definitely impact what they might be eligible for in terms of a subsidy through the exchange. And all of these are, it's quite complicated, but it's just something that people need to be educated on. We're spending a lot of time on that. We have, in addition to our association, we also have an education foundation, and we are actually producing some of that material that you said that you needed. So I should make sure that I put you on our list so that you know that when we come out of that, to help employees understand what they're eligible for, as well as the individuals. And then employers, some of them are quite frantic, actually, not knowing how they're going to comply, whether people will participate in the plans they offer. And so there's just a lot of work to be done. And I guess I would just want to close real quickly for this part by saying that our interest is in stability. We think that this frantic feeling that people have is not useful or good for anyone. And so we are working very hard to try to keep employers doing what they're doing if they're offering coverage today, to answer questions that people have, to make it simpler for them to understand things. And we definitely think that all of us have to work together, navigators, assisters, brokers, to make sure that everyone gets covered and understands the opportunities that are available to them. So with that, I'll close, and we can move forward.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much, Janet. So before Karen and I open it up to the larger group for Q&A, we just wanted to give an opportunity to the panelists to give any reactions or if you have any additional comments based on what you heard, or if you have questions for one another.
I have one thing.
Okay.
I think one thing that I wished I had said and I meant to say but I didn't is that the other problem that we encounter on our hotline, and I'm sure everybody else here has it too, and on our community groups, is that, you know, families and employment groups don't come in tidy packages, right? Not everyone's eligible for job-based coverage. Not everyone's eligible for Medicaid. Not everyone's eligible for SCHIP. Not everyone's eligible for Medicare. Like, you're going to have – one of the things that as we move forward is, you know, we have a patchwork quilt of healthcare system – of a health coverage, you know. And so we have to find, you know, under which patch – in the patchwork quilt, the different members of the family or the different members of the employee groups fit. And I just think that's one of the things that is a challenge with our healthcare system and why we need all these boots on the ground, whether it's through the broker, you know, agent producer community or the community advocates or even a more formalized, you know, professionalized consumer assistance program or navigator program. And I think it's just challenging to get everybody up to speed on all the different forms of coverage, including the consumers and the small business employees and the media. So
But yeah, I thanks, Elizabeth. And I just want to also add that as these families don't come in tidy packages, neither do our states or our communities. And so just to kind of put another exclamation point behind the need for a diverse group of navigators, assisters, brokers, all of the people who are going to be providing assistance. In Ohio, we have large segments of the various Asian people who speak the various Asian languages, Spanish, Russian, Somali. We have the second largest Somali community in the United States in Columbus, Ohio, where I live. And so that's going to be really important. And the data shows that people really want that face-to-face assistance. So we know that there will be call lines and you know, we know people can go online. But really, people are going to want to sit down with someone who can speak their language. And the other thing we face in Ohio is that we have some very rural areas. I mean, you know, I think 29 of our 88 counties are in Appalachia. And people go long distances there to get to face-to-face assistance. They are poor. They have there are areas where there's not good connection on the internet. People have cell phones with limited minutes, and they can't call 800 numbers and stay online. So there's just a lot of issues that you don't realize until you start really thinking about it. And so having this diverse group of people doing the assistance is just going to be incredibly important. I don't think I can stress it enough.
I guess I just wanted to comment. I was struck by a couple of things from our panel discussion, a couple of themes. One, I guess, this anxiety and kind of the disconnect between what people know now and what they'll need to know in 6 months. I take to heart Janet's urge that, you know, stability is what we need to be going for. It would have been nice if the 3 years since enactment had just been about implementation, but it has not. It's been about a lot of fighting, and I think that has surely added to the anxiety of what people don't know. So that, I guess, will be another important challenge to overcome. Hopefully one that can be overcome quickly. I have a sense from just our talking before that all of you see a range of kinds of questions and problems, and a lot of them are pretty simple. If you can just get people to sit down for 5 minutes, you can say, oh, no, see, you didn't check that box. If you resubmit that, that'll get paid. Or, no, it's not canceled. Here's what you're going to get. So this kind of, you know, oh, how's it going to be? How's it going to be? May go a little bit longer. But if there are people out there, the brokers that people know, these new programs that they maybe don't know, these established programs that they know pretty well, you know, if there are stationed out there folks with answers or folks who can help you get answers, that a lot of this may really drop a lot starting in October or in January. I was also kind of struck a little bit by the disconnect. And Kathleen, I think you talked about this, getting engaged. I used to be on the board of the high-risk pool in my state, and you know, here's another program where we built it and made it available, and like nobody, the phone was not ringing off the hook when it first opened. And what we found in trying different things is you really need to get to people when they need to know what they need to know. You can do ads, and we'll see a lot of that, and that'll help. And you can do general public awareness, but there's only so much, I think, that working parents are going to spend time kind of studying up on the ACA. You know, as Nancy said, they need to know what they need to know when they need to know it. So part of the trick is to be available and to be easy to find when the people, you know, need questions. What we found with the high-risk pool was you know, we started thinking, well, when do people need to know? They need to know when they get turned down from coverage. And so we not only had the notice that says, you know, this kind of legal notice, oh, you're eligible for this, but we actually stuck the application for the pool in the denial notice and told the carriers to do that. And so then the letter just said, sign your name here, send this in, and you'll have this coverage instead. And all of a sudden it kind of went up. So I think a lot of the strategies for sort of how to be available for the people when they need coverage are going to be very important too. So I don't know. How's it going to go in Ohio? I mean, how will you be? You're just getting started, right? This grant announcement has just started out. What will be the challenges for kind of getting up and running?
I think the challenges will be, we know right now of one organization that plans to put in an application, and they're a very credible statewide organization. We don't know about others. But I think the real challenge is going to be you've got $2 million, and how do you divide this? You want to subcontract with groups that have really deep roots and credibility in the African American community, in the Asian community, in the Hispanic community, et cetera, et cetera. And we're trying to spread $2 million around to do that. It's a challenge. I mean, it's a huge challenge. And then the other challenge that I find is that we do a lot of work to train people to go out and talk in their communities. And that's because they come to us and they say, I want to be trained and I want to go out and talk to my neighbors and all. And that works well to the extent of getting people to be aware and to know the basics of the Affordable Care Act. But what we're finding is that the kinds of questions, just like Nancy's, are so specific that we need a lot of highly trained people. And then turning to Janet, I think that's, you know, we're glad that we're going to have, that we have, you know, good relationship in Ohio with the brokers and agents there. And yes, I mean, it's like all hands on deck. We all have to be working on this, and the people who have the most knowledge have the most to offer, and so those partnerships are just going to be critical.
I've been struck. We are a national organization, and a lot of what we do is try to point people in the direction of getting the information that they need. With health insurance, it's very difficult because every state is different. And as I'm listening to all of the stuff that's going on, I'm thinking that we're laying on another whole bunch of new entities that are going to be working with people. And I think the challenge is going to be there's a big thing. There needs to be, to me, some kind of starting place where people can, that we could say, you know, to get started, go to hopefully healthcare.gov will look like that. But that can kind of waft people along until they finally get to where they can get an answer to their question. And a lot of what comes to me is people who have tried to do that and they've hit a dead end. You know, and I would hate to think that they're going to hit a dead end here. I've had people with weird situations where they've said, "I've called my state consumer assistance program if there is one." You know, I've talked with whoever, and nobody can answer my question. And I really hate to say it because, I'm glad that I'm not the only one here who's seeing that. You know. You said this once to me, if you've seen one health insurance benefit structure, you've seen one health insurance benefit structure. And I kind of am thinking the same thing about a lot of these family situations.
Nancy, just to react to that, I think it makes sense to try to get people to someone who can help them get started. But ideally, we don't want people bouncing around too much. So I'm curious if Elizabeth has any thoughts on how we can get people to the right place from the get-go so that they can just go to the person that could help them the most and then they can avoid having to get bounced around.
Well, just on the sort of as a precursor to that, on the you've seen one health insurance benefit package, you've seen one health insurance benefit package. For our small group market in New York State has over 15,000 different product lines. You know, we only have 1.6 million people in small group coverage, and, you know, all of them are basically, as Nancy well knows, congregated in a couple hundred. But the idea that, you know, people can just go out on their own and wade through stuff, so one of the fantastic things about the Affordable Care Act is we now have an opportunity to kind of regularize some of this, you know, so much choice is no choice kind of moment we are in. We're in the current, in the present state. And so what the New York State Department of Insurance is doing is, first of all, on these, on the exchange, both in the shop exchange, the small business health options program exchange, as well as in the individual exchange, you will have, you'll still have a lot of choice, probably too much choice, but it'll at least be organized in a more structured and streamlined way. And the act does that. People will have these minimum essential health benefits. There will be, you know, there'll be, you know, you'll be able to do apples to apples comparison on the marketplace. But beyond that, the department in New York has said, look, we're also going to standardize the subscriber contracts. So what, you know, what the benefit offerings are and the rules of engagement, if you will all sort of have to be following the a similar or substantially similar model, which will really make helping the 60,000 people we help every year a lot easier, because it's really a pain. We have to call up the carrier and get a copies of that individual, you know, employee's or employer's subscriber contract, and that can be a total pain, I can assure you, because we, like everyone else, has to wait for an hour on hold. So, you know, not always, but it feels like a lot. So I think one of the ways we can do this is there's these certain life events that have happened. California adopted a bill. New York's considering something as well, where we know, as Karen says, that there's going to be a moment. You're terminating coverage, get notice of the exchange. You're adopting a kid, get notice of the exchange. You're going to court, you're getting divorced, get notice of the exchange. So, you know, you're registering for a driver's license or whatever. I mean, there's these government interaction with government moments where we should be having notice of the exchange in this marketplace out there. And then for the individuals who have problems, I think the moment you get an explanation of benefit, that the bottom of the explanation of benefit, our hotline's there. And so, is, you know, I think the Department of Insurance also runs help and other things like that. So there's these moments, there's logical moments where we can get the word out. And we're, of course, also up on the State Department of Health's Insurance Exchange website already. So people do seem to find us. We have a pretty big book of business. You know, we handle 60,000 folks a year. So, and we expect to be handling a lot more. And happily so. It's our job. We're excited about it.
Oh, okay. Let me just, this is just very quick. So I agree with everything that Elizabeth just said. And then there are the others. So one of the things, and I'll just use the D.C. as an example, because we've been working a lot on the D.C. exchange trying to make sure that it's functional and going to be available and that there are enough helpers in various categories. But, you know, you have situations here where people have never left their ward in their life, ever, for any reason, and they don't. And so we have to make sure that we can go to them. We have to think about arranging things like enrollment fairs where we have agents and brokers and assisters there, because there will be a lot of people there and we've got to go into that ward. And we have to take it to them. We have people that that don't, that's, and let's think about how you pay for it. So they'll have to pay something, remember, if it's private coverage. They don't have a checking account. How do you, they operate on a cash basis. So we still have some things to figure out. Mm-hmm. That's my point. We've got to figure out all of the people that we need to touch and how we're going to help them. And we have a lot to do still. And so those are just, I wanted to throw just those couple little things out. And they don't, and how much money do I make? Well, if you ask them how much money they make, if they're paid through an employer and they get a paycheck, it's whatever that net paycheck is, not their gross pay. This is how much I get per week. That's what my pay is. Not whatever it actually is before taxes and anything else was deducted out. So and that greatly impacts what they're actually available for in terms of a subsidy. So there are a lot of things like that. When we think about education, it's not even just about what the new things are and the subsidies. It's education even beyond that, about to people who have never, ever been covered by insurance before or a public program. So they're starting off with zero knowledge base. And it really is going to take a lot of cooperation and reaching out and patience to reach all of the people that we need to reach.
I think hands are going up, so I think it's time to start broadening our conversation to include everyone.
Bob Rosenblatt, freelance writer. I'd like to understand better the intersection of what exists with what will exist. For Elizabeth Benjamin, are you going to apply to be a navigator and to be an assister? For Karen, is it a slam dunk that she'll get it for New York State? If she doesn't, someone else is the navigator, let's say someone with very deep political roots, then who trumps? As someone writing about it, who do I say people should go to, Elizabeth's group or the new navigator? And more importantly, who should customers go to?
Okay, well, the good news in New York is that I've already applied, and the state put out a request for proposals for $27 million, and we have 2.7 million insured. So compared to Kathleen's predicament, it's, you know, I don't know what that order of magnitude is, but it's big. And the way they structured the financing for it is that there's a maximum allocation each bidder can get per county. So there's no way there's only going to be one navigator for the state of New York. We already have a facilitated enrollment system that works with 36 community-based organizations around the state who are sort of leads, and they have subcontractors. And those guys essentially can only bid for about $15 million, given the way the county structure and financing works on the bid. And then there'll be an extra $10 million roughly in play. And so we put together a statewide bid because we already run a statewide operation that's of – and we tried to get – those facilitator enrollers tend to go for the very low-income folks that are currently eligible for public insurance programs, because for 15 years we've been enrolling people in CHIP and Medicaid in the through these community-based facilitated enrollers who are like proto-navigators. And so our bid, and I think others, people's bid, are trying to figure out, well, what's the next sort of level? There's new health insurance options available. We're now the ceiling's no longer at 100 or 150% of poverty. It's going up to 400 and beyond. Plus, there's all this small group, the options for tax credits. And so we're doing a bid with, just for example, and I'm sure others are as well, of a combination of chambers of commerce, retail worker groups, restaurant worker groups, young invincible young people groups. And so we've put together sort of an interesting, what we believe is a great package of sort of, you know, that sweet spot beyond, you know, with low income all the way up to sort of more moderate income folks, and that we think still will want assistance. So I don't know if that's helpful, but I don't think it's likely that, I haven't seen a lot of nepotistic behavior in our current procurement practices, at least for this kind of what's relatively in New York low-level money. Our graft is sort of at a harder liar level, you know. We want the mayor's office, you know. So, so not me, but, you know, that's what our guys do on the corruption level. So they don't really want to be messing around with doing all the hard work of this, like, direct enrollment and helping people. Like, that's not the big money. So, or power. So, I think we'll be all right in our navigator and enroller program.
And I would just add, I think I think the point of navigators is that they are supposed to be very kind of connected to the communities that they serve. This is supposed to be a boutique operation, and I think the brilliance of what Elizabeth has organized in New York and what has been organized on a similar model in other places, Massachusetts, other states, is to provide this network so that they're not all kind of free radicals out there, but that they all can come back to her. With her very smart lawyers and counselors and trainers who work there to get the backup they need, to get the technical assistance, to kind of work through this especially hard program so that they really can be organized and coordinated. And I think that's a really important model that a lot of other states are, if they're not doing it already, are looking to emulate. It's a way to make this work, I think, much more effectively.
Hi, Tony Hausner. I was formerly with CMS, and I'm expecting to be doing some work in consumer information. So I particularly want to ask Nancy, Laurie, and Karen, To what extent is HHS working with organizations like you in developing a consumer information plan? I guess that's one of my key questions. I've got many others.
Well, they're not working with me. no, I mean, I think the department is very organized. Full disclosure, I worked there at the very beginning of implementation for a short period of time. There has been, I think, the development of a lot of information resources. One of my first projects there was healthcare.gov to try to, kind of create in one place for the first time information about all of the plans that are available, as well as contextual information about how can you navigate in between them in the current market before all of these changes. I think they're working on other kinds of information resources. I know they've tried to staff out the CAP programs that Elizabeth works on. So I think there is a great deal of information being generated, and we'll probably be seeing more of that coming out, but I couldn't give you specifics because I don't work there anymore.
Oh, I can answer it pretty easily. I interact with them as a journalist. And, I think possibly because I'm not based in D.C., I'm up in New York, I find them very spotty, frankly. Very anxious about answering questions in public. Sorry?
Not just in New York.
Really not. I've experienced great difficulty being allowed to speak to people who are actually working on stuff. There's a really big kind of wall of very anxious press people who dole out information slowly and incompletely.
So they usually send us over information that they're working on, and I mean it's not that there's anything inherently wrong with what they're working on, but I find that it's not answering the questions that people are asking. So the questions that I'm getting are very specific, and people really need tools to help them really look at their own individual situation and figure out in this big law which parts of it are going to be helpful to them. And so that would be, if I were going to issue a criticism, I would say that's why we're producing so many materials, because it isn't there. And I think that that all of us will probably have to supplement what's coming out from the government in that fashion.
And I guess just to jump in and be a little defensive of my former folks, I think the original expectation was that, states would be taking the leads on doing the build on these exchanges, and then HHS would be able to be there in the background doing some of this other stuff. And it has not turned out that way. So the whole kind of implementation plan, I think, has turned out to be very different from what maybe was envisioned at the outset. And at least from the people I do keep in touch with, I know they are working very hard and very long hours to try to get it done. So we'll just have to kind of see how it works out.
Hi, I'm Penelope Pastronk, and I'm a private consumer. I have two questions. One, can you clarify exactly how the Affordable Care Act will impact the Medicare group? So are they outside these concerns that are being expressed, or is that another special population that needs to be addressed? And secondly, it's my understanding, and it may be incorrect, that brokers are financially incentivized towards certain plans. And is that correct? And how will that affect their role in this new scenario that we're entering?
Remember when I started off saying that the word agent, broker, and producer, it pretty much means the same thing? There are some people out there that are licensed and who work as an employee of an insurance company. But insurance brokers represent all of the plans that are available in the community. They don't just represent one plan. And most of the plans pay about the same, and it's not very much, by the way. So a broker wants to have a good volume of business in order to be able to make a living. They aren't paid a salary. They aren't paid for their office. Everything comes from those amounts that they get from the insurers. But there's no incentive to place with one over the other, and they're licensed across the board. If they weren't, they wouldn't be able to build up a clientele, because their whole objective is not to sell that one policy, but to build a client that they keep forever. Relative to your Medicare question, so some things with Medicare are kind of shielded by from ACA, but here's something that I'm seeing a lot, and I don't know if this is applicable to you tonight, but I think it's something for us to think about. We have a lot of people who are Medicare eligible that are still active employees. To the extent that they're still an active employee, guess what? It all applies. And we're seeing this so much more, and many of the questions that I'm getting that are submitted to us have to do with this exact scenario, that we do have an older workforce than we've had in the past. So I think it's a complicating factor, and it requires a person to be familiar with both systems.
If I could just add, with respect to the Medicare, there are benefits in the Affordable Care Act. The donut hole is closing. Preventive benefits now can be secured without a copay or being subject to a deductible. So to that extent, there are some very particular ways that the Medicare population is impacted, which actually already have started and will continue after January 1st because the donut hole won't close completely until about 2019. In terms of the broker question, I think that it gets kind of complicated. I don't want to get into long thing here, but some brokers do have relationships with some plans, and sometimes they don't have relationships with all plans. So I'm sorry. Oh, so in any event, I think that I don't want to actually say that they necessarily have an incentive, but it's just that unless they had a relationship with every plan, then you have that possibility, The other thing that I found when we were working on the legislation in our state, navigators are required to provide impartial information by law. And the legislation, which brings brokers into having certain requirements when they sell in the exchange, doesn't say they have to provide impartial information. So that's just something from a legal standpoint. I would have liked to have seen that in the bill as well, but that's just kind of how it had turned out.
Hi, my name is Antonita. You guys did a wonderful job, just so you know. I have two questions. One is for, I believe, Ms. Benjamin, or anyone else on the panel who has an answer. So a lot of things that you have been saying is that as a consumer assistance provider, you basically give information, instant information to the consumer as quick as possible. However, I'm wondering if there's any kind of connection or any gap bridging between the consumer and the provider, or if there's any working with the provider so that they make their information a bit more cohesive, or if there's any way that you're working with consumers so that they're able to advocate for themselves with their providers instead of having to use health educators or gap bridging.
I mean, we are not, I wouldn't want to misinform you and say we're promotores or community-based health workers that are doing diabetes education or that kind of work. We're really about helping people sort through insurance and getting access to care. That being said, we work a lot with consumers who providers with the sort of nexus between how the providers are getting paid by the carrier or not, or we help consumers who may not have health insurance work out deals with their providers so that they can continue to get care or get new care. For example, most hospitals have to provide charity care in New York State, and so we help, we have 44% of our folks are uninsured, right? So that's a lot of people that need to get access to low-cost or free health care. And so we help a lot of people with those kinds of issues as well. And then a lot of times, consumers that have called us say think that their insurance carrier is denying something when, in fact, a provider may say, no, actually, I don't think that's the right course of treatment for you. And so there's sometimes there's some conversations about sort of treatment plans and, what's really going on sometimes, because sometimes providers, they're under the gun. They have, these minutes that they're allocating, that they're, required to allocate to their patients, and sometimes they go a little fast, and so sometimes there's a little bit of conversations that have to happen there, too. Does that answer your question? But there is this whole other world of promotores and community-based health educators that work, on obesity campaigns and diabetes campaigns, and that's sort of a different kind of stream of sort of public health, I would say, advocacy.
Hi, my name is Jenny Gold. I'm a reporter with Kaiser Health News. I've got two questions. The first is, I'm covering this, and I'm still confused about what exactly navigators versus the brokers versus the in-person assisters are actually doing. Who is going out and telling people, yes, you're going to qualify for a subsidy, or yes, you're going to qualify for Medicaid and you need to enroll, and who's going to actually help someone pick their plan? Because that's a big deal, and I still don't really understand that. And my second question is, how are you going to be working with insurers? Obviously, they have a great incentive to get people, especially the young and healthy, signed up for these plans, and they're probably going to play a big role in enrollment. Are you going to work with the insurers themselves as navigators and assisters? Is it going to be a cooperative arrangement, or is this going to be like a separation of church and state kind of situation?
I'll try the first one, and then I'll maybe flip it back to Elizabeth on how they're working with insurers. The exchange help, all of those assisters are there to help people go through the simple streamlined application. Well, first to do outreach and to let people know, then to kind of go through this application. Wherever it is you're supposed to land in the exchange, you're not required to know that ahead of time. You just need to fill out the simple streamlined application, which asks you information that would be important for determining your eligibility for either of these paths that you go down, and then the result of that gets told to you, and then you can decide, am I going to Medicaid or am I picking a plan? So all of those assisters are can be part of that process, doing outreach, helping you kind of walk through the steps and answer your questions as you fill out the application. And then if you determine you're in the exchange and there are plans available, help you walk through, okay, here's the bronze ones, the silver ones, the gold ones. Here's where you can apply your premium subsidy. Here's where you can apply your cost-sharing subsidy. They're not the same. And here are the differences. The publicly funded assisters aren't supposed to tell you, well, this one's really better. But, you know, they can show you all the information that's available. Some of the plan performance information that'll be available in the first year will be a little thin because the implementation of that has been a little bit delayed. But eventually, in addition to the kind of standardized, here's the benefits that are covered, here's the deductibles, here's what you would have to pay if you got pregnant or if you got this. There's supposed to be other kinds of plan performance information. You know, this one has this kind of a network, and this one has that kind. This one has this track record for paying claims on time versus denying them, and this one has, you know, that kind of track record. This one has this kind of persistence enrollment versus that one. So eventually there will be other kinds of important measures that I think consumers want to see, and the navigators can kind of walk you through all of that. You can pick a plan. You can enroll. You can also go to one of Janet's folks, the way people have done all this time. You'll still need to go through the exchange to figure out what kind of help you're eligible for financially. But once you do, you can go to a broker and say, well, okay, now I see I could buy the Humana, the United, the Blue Cross policy. What do you think is better? The broker can tell you. So I think people can go down either path. Within states, and take a look at the snapshot that Jen Tolbert did, some are trying to build a kind of, you know, no wrong door assistance place, like what Elizabeth has, so that, you know, it doesn't really matter if one of her people is funded by IPA money versus Navigator money, right? They'll all kind of help you. In some other states, it may be a little more specialized. These guys are going to help just with outreach. These guys are just going to help with this, and then there have to be handoffs. I think that'll be trickier, but, you know, states that are trying that are at least, you know, thinking about how are we going to do this handoff kind of stuff. So, and maybe they'll modify over time if they can't figure out how to do that well. So does that? And then in terms of working with
the church and state,
the church and state
right. Question, you know, we have, you know, relationships with all the carriers in the sense that we talk to them. We talk to them on behalf of our clients. We are at stakeholder meetings with them. So we know them well. The one thing that we are sort of separated in the sense is that we're absolute purists. We don't take, you know, a dime from a carrier. So We're completely independent. And that's, you know, I think that's a selling point for some people, and other people, you know, if they know that somebody's on commission, for example, an insurance agent, maybe on a, you know, especially, you know, have a special relationship with the carrier, that may be a benefit in some ways because maybe they have special, you know, inroads with the carrier if there's a problem. But that's not our situation. We, you know, as an independent consumer assistance program and an independent navigator, we will be completely independent. We will be able – we have – relationships to resolve problems and to deal with enrollment snafus. So, but there's no financial relationship whatsoever.
And there isn't allowed to be in any of these publicly funded things. The rule is they can't be trying to sell you something.
I didn't mean so much a financial arrangement. I just meant in terms of sort of the overall outreach and marketing.
So we're all going to be working together. I mean, in New York, it's like we need every, you know, person on deck, you know, so we are all working really together. We talk to each other. We're all trying to understand each other's outreach and engagement plans. We'll be held, you know, over the next couple of months as the state reveals their public education and public engagement plan. We are all planning on meeting together and, you know, working to augment it if it needs augmentation or to, you know, support it if that's all it needs. So we're, that's, but we will be working together. I mean, they're, you know, this is not an adversarial moment, at least in New York. It's a moment to come together and make this thing work. It's, we're done with the, you know, we're done with the anxiety. We got to, like, diffuse the anxiety.
And I think, actually, I know Elizabeth has to catch a plane, so I think we need
cards.
To pause the formal Q&A here. Those of us who can stick around are happy to stick around and chat. Thank you all for coming. Please stay tuned to Consumer Assistance. It's going to be fun to watch it develop.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're great.
I'll leave those in case.